Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much, Mr. Host, for that news update. There'll be more news from Greg at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day in 1901, the Kingdom of Ashanti would be annexed by the British. Interestingly enough, this is what we call modern-day Ghana that would gain its independence in 1957. In 1926, on this day, Henry Ford would make some announcements that would forever change everybody's lives, introducing a 40-hour work week at Ford. Interestingly enough, on the exact same day, the International Slavery Convention was signed by 20 states. Make of that what you will. In 1977, on this day, the late Steve Biko would be laid to rest. In 1980, on this day, a comedian named Chevy Chase would get into a very uncomfortable situation after having said some things about a certain Cary Grant that would result in a $10 million defamation suit that would be settled out of court for an undisclosed amount. In 2005, on this day, Fernando Alonso would take his first ever Drivers' Championship title, finishing third in Brazil, but would go on to, of course, win the Drivers' Championship. In 2015, on this day, Caitlyn Jenner would be born, officially, that is, as Bruce Jenner would give up the name Bruce and assume the name Caitlyn. Interestingly enough, I wonder what happened to the 1976 Olympic gold medal and how that was resolved. In 2017, on this day, Young Sheldon would premiere, and in 2018, on this day, Bill Cosby would become the first celebrity to be jailed for 3 to 10 years under the Me Too movement. Obviously, we know why he was jailed and the charges that were laid before him. And on the exact same day, on the other side of the world, Michael Kors would announce that we'd be buying Versace for $2.1 billion. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments from the U.S. electoral landscape. We're going to be looking at the impact that U.S. elections could potentially have on markets. Now that the interest rate conversation is kind of out of the way, the U.S. elections become the next big focal point in America. And we're going to be looking at that with the team at Schroders, trying to understand that. Then we've got a conversation with the Hive Group around understanding the importance of technology in marketing and how you can use data analytics to improve your marketing and the businesses that you market for. Then we've got a conversation with microfinance around illegal lenders. As part of our consumer awareness segment, Warning Wednesdays, this week we're taking a look at illegal lenders that have let their licenses lapse or expire and how you can protect yourself against those. And then because it's a Wednesday, we've also got an executive lounge segment. We've got a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Osman Arbi. For those who don't know who that is the CEO of Motus. He's joining me in studio to reflect on a 40-year career and to look forward to what retirement could potentially look like for him.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day, and a gentleman who's showing no signs of slowing down and retiring at this stage joins me, as he does every Wednesday, this time from the United States, Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro. Uncle David, good evening. Lovely to speak to you, as always. The Chinese stimulus, do you want to start there?
Well, we knew it was going to happen. It happened. and it you know, it's changed markets, particularly from our point of view. You can see the commodity companies and you know, on the JSE really running away. A lot of room to make up. I was looking at the charts. I thought, okay, this is looking good, and then you don't even see a dent on the chart. But I mean, if this continues, which I think it's going to do, against the backdrop of stimulus in the other markets, you know, in terms of lower interest rates, I think, you know, as I've been saying, or hopefully you've remembered, you know, we're in for a good rock and roll year, still into this year and into next year as well. So we're going to have fun conversations from now on.
And those commodities prices as well. I kept an eye on them this morning. Commodities markets were up about 2.5% inside the first hour of trade, and had a bit of a pullback throughout the day. And I wondered, was that a bit of a short-lived situation? But I suppose, as you're saying now, it could just be the start of something that's going to be going on for a long time, because platinum prices are approaching $1,000 again.
Yeah. Look, you know, that's... They've come back. They came back to just, on 900. We want them up at, 1100, 1200, 1300, which they can do. I suppose it depends on the dollar as well. We've seen quite a bit of dollar weakness. Somewhere down the line, I think you're going to find a bottom in the dollar, and things could start turning. But I'm hopeful that once we get into a pro-growth environment, companies are going to start expanding. You're going to find lots of M&A into next year. New businesses being created and so on. So you get into we haven't had it. We haven't had this for 3-4 years from before COVID. We haven't had any really good growth in the global economy. And I think with rates coming down, it's just starting to position itself for that. So it takes time. It takes time to filter through into people's psyche. But certainly the signs are there at the moment.
Uncle David, when we look at the signs that are there, how are we feeling about the likelihood of a U.S. recession? You're in the U.S. at the moment. There's a lot of optimism. We're looking forward towards these elections. But obviously, that is still a concern at the back of some investors' minds to say, did we actually achieve the soft landing?
I think we're there. I can't see a recession, and maybe I'm in New York where maybe it's not really indicative or representative of the whole of the United States, but the number of tourists here, Jimmy, the UN is in town, United Nations. You cannot believe the traffic jams. You cannot believe how many people are here and what you're seeing. I've got to tell you something. You think there's a recession. There's a Dojo Cat and Post Malone concert in the park on Saturday. I'm trying to get tickets. The cheapest tickets go, I don't know, $100 a shot, And this is just a free concert in the park. So, there's just plenty of demand, plenty of spending going through to, what I'm glad to see as well is Broadway is recovering in a big way. And I can see it from what tickets are available. I go for the cheapies, like right at the end of each day or in the morning, they tell you which, couple of tickets are available for certain shows and you line up and decide and you get discounted because I can't afford, to buy them in advance. especially with the Rand, even at these levels. So, you can sense, you can sense a pace here that just doesn't point towards a recession. I don't see it in any way, in any way pointing if this is representative or not. So, and most of the commentators don't believe we're going to go into it. Jimmy, just off, there's a lot of discussion about the election. It just occupies almost 80% of the newscasts. Who's in the lead, where they are, where Trump was, where Kamala was, and so on. And a lot of interest around it and discussing their economic policies and that. But outside of that, if you do listen to commentators here, people, I don't think there's any positioning of, for recession. Generally, things get better once the election's out the way. So, I don't know.
We'll have to see how that one shapes up. Uncle David, the Rand hitting 17 Rand 20. We're excited about that. At the same time, the Aussie and the top 40 hitting all-time highs, the gold price hitting all-time highs. Clearly, we're in for some really good times locally, especially.
Well, what more could you ask for? The stars are aligned. I can see from some of the money that's coming into the market as well. What was worrying me was you could see some small and medium cap shares being bid up, a lot of volume behind it. And my big concern was the commodity side. But I think China's playing ball now, and I think they're not going to stop. And if they're going to go, they must go big. Otherwise they get into the Japanese situation, that Japan found themselves in the 90s when their property markets collapsed. And I think for 30 years they've been struggling to get out of it, deflation. So I don't think China wants to go into that kind of situation, realizes that if it's going to do something now, it's got to do something big. And that's going to be good for our market as well, because that's been one obstacle to holding us back. And you know how long we've been calling the bottom of the commodity market? Well, I think we've seen it. This week.
That's been a very long conversation. And obviously the China part of it now coming, as you said, coming into the space becomes that much more important. Our president is in the U.S. with you at the moment, trying to drum up investment, trying to speak for South Africa and speak for the African continent. What does the outlook seem to be like from a sentiment point of view, at least where it relates to emerging markets? Are we seeing that there's a lot more optimism?
I don't know. You know, it's so difficult to read that because the United Nations is such a huge organization and he's up there against so much competition. The one thing that Biden did say in his speech yesterday, I listened to Mr. Biden, and I think it's a good thing that he is standing down because I don't think we could have seen him for another 4 years. Genuinely, you know, I got so worried that he was going to blur his lines, you know, even though this is his last speech. But he did say that they're going to push for expanding the Security Council, you know, and to give more representation to Africa, which Mr. Ramaphosa, you know, mentioned in his talk, that there's no representation for Africa. This is the Security Council is, what, 78 years old or something like that. So things have to be have to happen, but it's also up to Africa to get its act together as well. I think with commodity markets showing a bit of promise, I think that does give us an opening to push forward.
Are we once again calling the bottom and saying now's the time to get in?
Yes. This time it's official.
This time it's official because the rest of the world believes us. We'll leave it at that, Uncle
Tim. All markets are good. You know, I'm looking at the US markets, yeah. And also just don't underestimate, you know, what a better China means for Europe as well, because like Germany do a lot of exports into China and the luxury goods side of it and that. So it's very important that we do see that pick up. So that was just the missing link. So officially we're in bull phase now.
We're back in business. All right, we're back in business. Everybody's going to benefit, and now's the time to make sure you have things sorted out. We'll leave it at that, Uncle David. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth joining me to reflect on the market movements, the upbeat sentiment that's returning to markets now, and what's causing that.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now that the interest rate decisions have come and gone and we finally got some clarity around what the US Fed plans to do from interest rate perspective, all eyes are now arguably going to be shifting towards the elections in the US. As that election race draws closer, as November draws closer, it's definitely going to be an interesting time to see how that election race affects markets, how it continues to shape up, and how we make sense of it. And to help me make sense of what this could potentially mean for markets and for sentiment at the moment, I'm joined on the line by Sebastian Mullins, who is head of multi-asset and fixed income at Schroders Australia. Good evening, Sebastian. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by taking a look at the current kind of election campaigning that's been taking place. Have markets started to sway in any particular direction, or markets kind of leaning any particular direction, whether it's Democratic or Republican at this stage?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. It's a good question, and it's kind of hard to really dissect right now because you're thinking about what market is pricing, and you kind of break it up into two potential scenarios. I've seen one party say that normally when the incumbent party wins the election, because markets don't like uncertainty, that typically drives the S&P higher. So some are saying higher S&P numbers right now sort of lead the market to price in a Harris victory. That said, it's kind of hard to see now given the fact that Trump is, you know, leading on tax cuts as one of his main policy agenda items. So that would also likely push equities higher. So I think it's too early to say right now if the market is pricing anything. That said, if you look at betting odds, which is a type of market, that's showing Trump slightly ahead as of last week, but neck and neck, to be totally honest. It's really hard to see who could potentially win at this point, given we still have 6 weeks out from the election.
Sebastian, when we look at the two different parties or two different candidates, they also kind of represent two different policy directives. We know very clearly, as you alluded to, the stance that presidential candidate Trump has on taxes and on American economy versus what the current deputy or current vice president would have in mind. How do we understand the policy conversation around it, understanding that whichever party wins, we could either see a continuation of the current policy or a change of policy?
The thing we have to think about in both scenarios is, one, we kind of know what Trump's policies are because he's pretty much running on the same campaign he did when he was in office. So it's more of a known, and we can talk about that in a moment. But when it comes to Harris, I think her policies, they haven't been fleshed as much as you'd expect at this point in the race. And I think, A, because she's a new entrant, if you think about how long the election's been going, but also it doesn't really work in her favor to release too many policies right now. So the big difference, we'd say, would be the tax cuts. Based on how the Senate and the House elections coming up, it seems harder for Harris to have a blue wave where she wins both houses. Possible, but seems less likely. So it seems more likely that either candidate would win with a divided Congress, which means when it comes to tax cuts, it could be harder for either party to get their votes through. That said, if you believe both of them deliver on what they promised, Trump would be cutting taxes, rolling off his tax cuts he already had in place because they're expected to mature soon, to continue those. But there's also talk about reducing taxes on corporates from 21 down to, say, even 20 to 15, whereas Harris is saying she wants to increase tax rates. Now, that would have two very likely different impacts to the economy, but I would say it'd be harder for Harris to put that through. Again, we do not think she's going to win in a blue sweep.
Sebastian, what does an S&P 500 or a U.S. economy look like if President Trump returns? Does that look better or worse from an investment point of view, a sentiment point of view, and just a general sense of risk?
There's probably, I guess, three components to that question. One is what happens to the economy, what happens on earnings, what happens to equity markets. So we start with the first one, what happens in terms of policy on the economy? If Trump were to win, I mean, you can categorize his policies into sort of four main ones in two separate buckets. The first one being policies that would lead to higher inflation. So those are the immigration policies and the tariff policies. Now, immigration is a big concern for the country, but people entering the workforce more recently, whether it be legal or illegal immigration, has actually pushed inflation lower because you've seen wage costs go down. And mechanically, it's pushed unemployment higher. So if he just delivers on his immigration policies, you would see mechanically unemployment fall, but wage costs go higher, which is inflationary. Tariffs, we know, have their own impacts on goods. He's saying to put 10% tariffs on all goods and 60% on China goods. That said, you know, Harris or even Biden, when he was in power, he didn't remove any of Trump's tariffs. So it's hard to say one would be more aggressive on China than the other. But to offset those inflationary policies I mentioned with the immigration and tariffs, this is deregulation and tax cut plan. So deregulation, you know, removes red tape, uses profits, allows banks to lend, and then tax cuts allow, you know, margins to improve and the economy hopefully to improve because of that sort of fiscal spending by not collecting as much money. Those two growth components should offset the inflation components and lead it to a higher GDP or nominal GDP under Trump and Harris. That said, impact on earnings is a bit questionable because, first of all, he can do two of the things with executive order, but he can't do tax cuts without Congress. So while we think in aggregate that will lead to better corporate earnings under a Trump than Harris presidency, with higher tariffs and wage growth, a lot of these things might lead to volatility. So it should lead to higher nominal earnings, higher utilizations. So we do assume higher earnings under Trump. But then what does that mean to the S&P? Well, that should be good for the S&P. But typically, the market follows earnings over medium term. Short term, it could be volatile. So negative factors like mismatched timings between the inflationary policies and the tax cut policies could lead to some wobbles in the market. That might lead to higher bond yields. It could put pressure on earnings. So long story short, it'd be positive for earnings and positive for the S&P and for the economy, but likely with far more volatility with those change in sentiments, depending on how his rhetoric evolves while he's president.
Sebastian, what about emerging markets? How are emerging markets, and I suppose largely the rest of the world and the rest of the global economy, likely to respond to, say, a Harris waltz, a win for the Democrats? Is that likely to continue to spur on confidence within the markets? Is that likely to have a dampener on that?
So I think the Harris victory, if you think about emerging markets as your first point, again, I'm not sure if they will remove any of the current tariffs in place. So if you think about Biden, he kept all of Trump's tariffs, and in fact, he increased them by putting 100% tariffs on solar and EVs. So I think Harris might have less rhetoric. So you're not going to see tweets, you know, from President Trump calling Xi things online like we saw back when he was in power. But I don't see necessarily a China-friendly call its outcome from either party. If anything, Trump might be doing that to get a deal. So when it comes to China, I think that's probably still an issue from the U.S. EM ex-China, I think it's case by case. So countries like India should do well. Commodity-linked countries like South Africa might do well if you see just stability and geopolitical stability in place. Probably more important is the Federal Reserve delivering interest rate cuts. So that 50 basis points right now allows the rest of the world to start their cutting cycle, less pressure on emerging market currencies, less interest expense for those borrowing in dollars. So that's probably going to see a more beneficial backdrop for emerging market countries ex-China, whereas the China question is probably still going to be in the crosshairs, regardless who wins.
Certainly some interesting times ahead, and we're going to keep an eye on these developments as they continue to unfold, because the US election, whether we like it or not, has a bearing on financial markets, on global markets, and on global sentiment. I think we'll leave it at that, Sebastian. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Sebastian Mullins, head of multi-asset and fixed income at Schroders Australia, sharing his thoughts around the potential impacts of the US elections on markets.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by The Hive Group. In the digital world that we live in, information is so important, and being able to analyze that information can be the difference between the success and failure of your business, especially when you're looking at the marketing aspects of it. I'm joined on the line by the founder and CEO of The Hive Group, Yao Jomo, to take a look at the role of advertising and the role of technology in advertising. Good evening, Yao. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of marketing technology, the core functionalities that we see in the marketing space, and kind of how that has changed in the African continent over the last couple of years.
Good evening, Jimmy. Thank you very much for having us. So the Hive Group has been around for 10 years. We started as a creative business, and we morphed into we brought in technology element. We use technology, but now what we did, we built the capacity via our MarTech stack, and we decided to split the business into two, the creative and the content part, which still remains Idea Hive. And then the Tech Hive is where all the fun and exciting stuff on AI, on technology, on insights and data and whatever you sit. So that is where we are. And the challenge for marketing practitioners, I think for most of us, has been such that we all think we can create content. We all think we can advertise a product, a service, or a solution. But the trick here is that we all have changed. We're not one homogeneous group. So what technology does is that it enables us to really understand our audiences properly, to segment them properly, and that to provide them with the right content at the right time, on the right platform, to the consumers or the audiences. And in so doing, it enables consumers to also make informed decisions on their purchases and buying decisions as well.
Yeah, when we look at the marketing landscape, obviously businesses that look to make use of marketing services, which essentially should be every business in the world today, typically each business has their own challenges or has their own little unique requirements from a marketing perspective. What are some of the challenges that you're seeing that businesses are facing when implementing these new marketing kind of tech solutions that don't necessarily serve them to the best of what they could be?
Yeah, I think the main challenge is understanding the role and importance of marketing technology and what value it will bring to their businesses. Right. So a case in point is, like I alluded to earlier, really understanding who your audiences are. or your consumers and serving them properly on the right platform with the right offers on at the right time. So understanding that marketing technology is there to help you make these really difficult strategic decisions. The second thing, this is a massive, as we would all appreciate, cost of tech is really high, right? So it's understanding that this is a long road that you're going to take and that the return on investment, it's going to take a bit of time for you to realize that particular return on investment that you're seeking. So those are the two. And the third one is adaptation. Because we don't understand it, because there are concerns and because of the complexities around making that particular decision, acquiring it and deploying it, and really ensuring that you sweat that particular asset to see your return on investment, which will be over a 3 to 5 years horizon, and sometimes maybe longer, it makes businesses a bit skittish when it comes to such investment, and that they would also then stay or stick to what they've been used to. But if you continue doing that, like I always say to my team and to clients, that it will sound crude, but you will die a slow and painful death. It's really, you will lose your audiences, you will lose your market share, and by extension, you're going to be compromised on return on investment for your shareholders. So it's better to make these decisions upfront and amortize it over a period of time, so you could then see the return on investment over that particular horizon.
Let's look at the role of automation and artificial intelligence. Obviously, the marketing landscape now looks very, very different to what it did, say, 5-10 years ago. And that obviously filters into how businesses have to make decisions around the best strategies and the best ways forward. But the impact that technologies like AI and automation can have in bettering the business or in bolstering your overall strategy. Take me through some of the good benefits of having that in place.
Okay. So we all need it. As market brands need AI, brands need technology, right? First and foremost, you have to, as any business or any brand, from a marketing point of view, you have to invest in MarTech and the MarTech stack. That is marketing technology tools and processes, and you blend that with people. So that is very important. So invest in your MarTech stack. And MarTech stack is a function of what your business's strategic goals are. So it will work around data collection, around insights, around analytics, quantitative and qualitative analysis. And using all this information, so it's normally split into two. One part will look at creative efficiencies or content efficiencies. So we use a tool that enables us to really maximize return on investment on content and creative deployment. So instead of having a studio full of people, we have this tool that will then customize and ensure efficiencies on the content that we want to deploy or the particular creative that the client wants. So it ensures that there is efficiency, it ensures that there is agility, adaptability, and all those fine elements that you don't need to have a studio full of people. But these particular tools enable you to deploy these things at the speed of light, and also enables the creatives who are then doing this particular work to actually look for value-adding solutions to the client, for the brand, instead of sitting there and resizing stuff, right? So first and foremost, tech would enable efficiencies for you in a very massive way. The second thing it does, it enables you to really hone in on understanding your consumers. So you will be able to use AI to do social listening, to do community management, to be able to write the proper brand and campaign strategy and tactics, right? When you understand all these things from really understanding your consumer's point of view, you then be able to serve them with the right and appropriate content pieces at the right time. So unfortunately, if we don't, as a brand, if we don't stick to these sort of parameters or adapt these tools, you will be missing your consumers once again.
Don't miss your consumer. Make sure you target your marketing or you tailor your strategies to your client, to your businesses. And if you need any help, speak to the guys at Hive. They've probably got a solution waiting for you. Thank you so much, Yao. That was Yao Dromo, who is a founder and CEO at the Hive Group, joining me to take a look at the importance of technology in the world of marketing. This interview was brought to you by The Hive Group, where innovation meets communication and tech fuels creativity.
Welcome to The Hive Group, where innovation meets communication and technology fuels our creativity. We merge precision and brand communication through analytics, data, insights, and technology. Doing more, faster, from developing CRM systems and immersive online experience to automating content and social media marketing. The Hive Group. Communicate, elevate, innovate.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's time for another Warning Wednesday. This week we are taking a look at the illegal lending space, what you need to know about that space, what you need to avoid about that space, and how you can protect yourself. I'm joined on the line by the CEO at Microfinance South Africa, Leonie van Pletsen, to take a look at this. Leonie, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by taking a look at the lending space as a whole. Obviously, with different economic circumstances, with everything that's happened and interest rates where they are, people find themselves being drawn unnecessarily or necessarily so to borrowing more to service certain things. Where do we start when we look to approach a lender or we look to vet a lender?
Good evening and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you tonight. Yes, my name is Leonie van Pletsen. I represent Microfinance South Africa, and we are the registered credit providers of South Africa. So I think taking the economic situation into consideration and, you know, where consumers find themselves is if they want access to credit, they should definitely look at lenders that are national credit regulator registered. I think it's very important to make use of the registered credit providers to have fair access to credit.
Leonie, when we look at those national credit providers that are NCR approved, there are 4,000 of these providers now that have a license, that have let this license lapse, and we'll look into the implications of that in a second. I want to look at the implications first of dealing with someone who is not approved or whose license has lapsed. What's the difference between a legal lender and a lender who is effectively an illegal lender because either the license has lapsed or they never bothered getting the license in the first place?
Yes, I think, you know, illegal lenders in South Africa is a major problem, and we are really seeing them flourishing and thriving in the communities. You know, the first thing that they don't do is they don't do proper credit checks. They ask exorbitant rates, and we're looking at between 50 to 100% per week or per month. You know, they're asking to retain your cards, your ID documents, and they don't explain any documentation. The other thing that we also see is they ask for upfront fees, which is not allowed, where, you know, the legal credit providers, they are NCR registered, they do a proper affordability. You know, we are limited within the National Credit Act on the caps that the association's members, you know, according to the National Credit Act, can ask, and there's no upfront fees.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is the fact that there's actual framework that governs how much a lender is allowed to charge you, how much a lender can recover in terms of what they've charged you and what interest rates that they can charge you at. Leonie, how do we verify lenders? If I have someone who's got a lending agreement and they say they're an authorized lender, is there somewhere I can go on to perhaps the NCR website, enter in a number and just verify that this person's license has indeed not lapsed?
Yes, so you can go onto the NCR's website, www.ncr.org.za, and then what they basically do is they can enter in the NCRCP, and it stands for National Credit Regulator Credit Provider Number, and there you can verify if this if this is still a registrant or if the registration has lapsed.
Leonie, you mentioned some of the flags to look out for. I want to look at some of those flags in a bit more detail. Red flags where I can't have access to information or where a potential creditor is limiting certain things or not being transparent. What are the easiest red flags that should tell me as a consumer, walk away?
Well, the thing is, if the credit provider does not want to explain your contract to you, that is an immediate red flag, because we are in a capped environment. You know, the first loan that we can charge is 5%, and for the second loan, it's 3%. It's the same as all of the other credit providers, and the banks actually charge the same price. So as soon as a credit provider says, you know, I'm not going to explain this information, or you should pay an upfront fee in order to get access to credit, that's immediately a red flag.
Leonie, can I report this to the NCR or to anyone? If I, for example, have had a creditor or a lender that's given me an NCR number, the NCR number may have been valid at some point. Suddenly, it is no longer valid. Is there something, for some form of recourse I have as a consumer to say, this person is now lending without or lending as an illegal lender, and can I recover my money back from that?
Yes, definitely. You know, the NCR is also enforcing on these illegal credit providers. So you can report them to the National Credit Regulator. You can report them to the MFSA, because we work in collaboration with the NCR. And then you can also report them to the National Financial Ombuds. The National Financial Ombud is also there for the consumer to make sure that they are protected.
Leonie, the 4,000 odd providers whose licenses have lapsed, what does that mean for you, for consumers? Should we now not be seeing their credit numbers appear? How does that all work? Because it's very difficult for someone who might not be in the credit space as you are to try and distill between whether someone's license has lapsed or it hasn't.
So I think if you look at the NCR certificate, make sure it's the right year. So, you know, they would have a certificate that has the right date stamp on and that it's not outdated. So that is the easiest way to identify if a credit provider's registration has lapsed. The lapse is definitely an issue. You know, we are seeing that certain credit providers, they just don't want to register with the NCR, and they become illegal credit illegal lenders. But I think the easiest way to identify them is to look at the date stamp.
So when we talk about a lapsed date stamp or an old date stamp, I'm assuming this means that on a periodic basis, these memberships or these licenses have to be renewed with the NCR. Is that the case?
Yes, annually all of these membership has to be renewed, and that's why I say our members are all renewed with the NCR. So if you are unsure, you can also look at an MFSA, a microfinance member. It's a blue, white and black logo, and then the association is also there, that if there is a credit provider that doesn't deal according to the National Credit Act, we also follow a process to make sure that they are compliant.
That is the Microfinance Institute, or Microfinance South Africa, rather, helping you stay ahead of this. Thank you so much, Leonie, for bringing this to our attention. Thank you for sharing so much information around this. Those of us that are listening out there, please be sure to do your vetting, do your research, do your homework. The last thing you want is to have funds loaned to you at an exorbitant rate that you can't pay off. Leonie van Pletsen, CEO of Microfinance, on the rise or the increase in illegal lenders and what you need to be aware of.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Wednesday, it's Executive Lounge time, and this week's Executive Lounge is a very special conversation with a CEO who's had quite the colourful career in the public space, a gentleman who has been in the working world north of four decades and is set to retire at the end of October. So this will effectively be potentially the last conversation that we have recorded with the outgoing CEO at Motus, that is Mr. Osman Arbi, and he joins me in studio for this conversation. Good evening, Uncle Osman. Thank you so much for taking the time. The last time you and I spoke, I remember you said you were going to be retiring, and I thought this is the one conversation we have to have before you retire. It's been four decades of work, it's been a colorful career, and it's all coming to an end.
Good afternoon, Jimmy, and to your listeners. Yeah, you're quite right. When we spoke the last time, I said I'm coming to the end of my career. My career started in January 1981 as an audit clerk, doing my articles at Deloitte & Touche in those days. Today it's known as Deloitte. And after articles, I just stayed on, and I said for 23 years in total. And after that, I joined one of my clients, very prestigious, Imperial Holdings in those days. And 6 years ago, I was very privileged that I was in the position to unbundle the motor division out of Imperial Holdings, and we listed separately on the stock exchange. So we broke into two. Imperial was then bought out by Dubai World. Motor stayed on its own, and in our first year of listing, our operating income was 3.5 billion. And in June this year, we just reported 5.5 billion. So all in all, it's the right time to go after 43 years in the career. And Imperial Motors has been a great place where I could use my entrepreneurial skills. And it's time to give the younger generation an opportunity to take it further.
How does 43 years look? I mean, we've run through kind of like the cliff notes and the highlights around the Deloitte and then the Imperial. How does a career that spans pre-democracy into democracy, into a new kind of government that we have now, how has that experience been?
Jimmy, you're a youngster like my children. So when I talk to them about the times when we had to study, they don't believe me and you wouldn't believe me, but I'm going to tell you now either way. So I couldn't study at Wits because of the wrong color. I couldn't study at UCT. So I landed up at University of Durban Westville, which was meant for Indians. And I could have jippoed my health by getting a certificate for being asthmatic, and maybe Wits would have taken me, but I decided not to do that and study at UDW. And that was the only Indian university that would accept us to do an accounting degree. I finished off there in 1981. I found myself in a very privileged situation because none of the big five audit firms would employ people of color. And at that time, Deloitte and Touche, now Deloitte, had just started employing people of color. And we were employed by Deloitte in 1982, January. And that's the first time I was 22 and a half years old that I worked with white people, eating with a knife and fork, and getting used to this environment where I wasn't only with Indian, colored, and African black people, because that I was used to, because I grew up in that environment. But now I was in a different environment, and I got used to it. And in 1982, started in January and developed my career as an article clerk, and then as a manager, and then as a partner. And ultimately, I headed up the audit division for Deloitte in Johannesburg, where I had 40 partners, 80 managers, and 400 staff. So it was a long journey, but a fruitful one. Because, I mean, I didn't grow up with a golden spoon in my mouth. Mm. I came from a farming town that you'll all remember is Dalstrom. I was born there. I could never school there because there was no Indian schools. So I schooled in Belfast, went to Standerton, which had the only Indian boarding school which I could go to for high school. So I went there and landed up at University of Durban Westville for my studies. So again, what did that teach me? A lot of independence, standing on your own, and doing what you have to do. And don't worry, at UDW, I did quite a bit of a mandla. I've been tear gassed. I've been hit by a baton. So that's part of growing up. And in 82, when I joined Deloitte, I continued, and I was very fortunate that I had some very good partners, some very good mentors that carried me through those difficult times, because apartheid was alive and well, and it wasn't easy. I had to live in Lanesia and travel to work every day, 1.5 hour in the morning, 1.5 hour in the evening. But once you work with good people, and I was working for a good firm, and 23 years flew by. And then I joined one of my clients. In fact, Imperial was one of my audit clients for 5 years before I joined them. And when I was called in by the then CEO, Bill Lynch, who was a ex-Irish individual that came to South Africa with the matric certificate and then grew the Imperial business study, listed it. And he said to me, I thought we had done something wrong at the audit. And he said to me, I'm looking for a black CA. So I said, am I not black enough? And he said, no, but you're overqualified. So I said, I'm a partner in a firm, so what? I'm a chartered accountant. I'll do what you want me to do. And a week later, I got a piece of paper from him to say that this is your first year salary. This is your title. This is your first year's incentive. And the job title read, is what you make of it. He got up from his chair. If you know Bill Lynch, he's a big guy. He got up in front of me, shook my hand, and he said, boy, I'll look after you. I shook his hand, and that was a deal. That was how deals were done, I suppose. And 20 years later, I'm retiring. So I'm not complaining. I mean, even in the 20 years, I had great roles. But I work for great people like Bill Lynch and Hafiz Mohammed and all the other people that were CEOs in the business, Hubert Brody and Mark Lamberti. So I worked with a great team developed great skills. And then fortunately, in my last 6 years, I was allowed to use those skills as a CEO of Motus. And I feel very comfortable that I leave 20,000 people behind with a market cap of 21 billion rand. So I think my job's done. And I can put hand on my heart and say I can enjoy my retirement now with my family, with my wife and my grandchildren and my children. So that's what I want to do.
Looking back on a career like that, did you at 22 and a half joining Deloitte, did you ever imagine that you'd be the CEO of a listed entity in any space?
Jimmy, this is a young boy from Dalstrom. Just managed to get a job. Got my first check of 450 rand. Do you think I was even thinking? All I was praying for is the end of articles. End of articles, you pray for a job that takes you to the next level. So no ways in my wildest dreams could I thought of what would have happened ultimately. So no, we took one step at a time. Apartheid was alive and well. Jobs were few and far between for people of color. So whatever you took, you treasured, you worked very hard, and you persevered and developed with the team. So no, I didn't think about it. It wasn't in my wildest dreams. But here it goes. I made it.
Uncle Osman, the career that you've had has obviously given you, as you said, a lot of opportunities, a lot of areas of experience to grow in. What are some of the treasured memories that you have from some of the experiences, maybe a travel experience or some of the things that you learned that you can say, you know what, I'm glad I was in that kind of situation because it did this for my character?
The first thing is because I had to leave home early, I got my independence very early. From class 1 to standard 5 in Belfast on my own, Monday to Friday, not leaving home with a lunchbox in your hand, that became my norm. At an early age, I had to go to boarding school in standard 6 and up to matric. And then I stayed in res for 1.5 years in Durban as well, and then in a flat. So, you know, independence was a key thing for me. That's what I developed, and I treasure till today, my independent way of doing things, my independent thinking. And then what I learned at an early stage is that whether you're in the audit profession or in the business world, it's all about people. If you work with good people, you surround yourself with good people, you can only go places. And I was very privileged that in my career at Deloitte, I was a staff partner. So I employed a lot of people out at WITS and at RAU in those days, at UCT, things like that. So I was in a very privileged position where I could recruit young people. They come in very green, but you develop them. And in 3 years' time, they leave after articles. And then you meet your people, their general managers, their CEOs. So to me, that was very rewarding. And we were in a very privileged position at that time where transformation was taking place. So my boss in those days was Israel Skosana. Now, it was a privilege to work with a bright guy like that. Came from Anglo-American as a bursar, and then we did our articles. He was my boss, worked with him, and I developed people as we went along. So, you know, for example, I recruited a young, not even a CA, a BCom grad called Luazi Bam. And then Luazi worked for me, and I said, Luazi, if you're coming to Deloitte, you better become a CA. He said, but I don't have money. I said, I'll sponsor you, but you better become a CA. And he did become a CA, a clever guy, and worked in the audit division, worked in the corporate finance, went to consulting, and ultimately became the CEO of Deloitte and Touche for Africa, and did that for 8 years. So I'm just saying that to me, that was the privilege. My job was my job. Mm-hmm. But developing people along the way was such an achievement that you enjoy see people grow and develop. And then you see them in big positions. It's just a privilege. It's just nice to feel that way. Because we, you know, everyone makes money, but developing people is not an easy skill. Mm. It's a very difficult skill, but I enjoyed it along the way and I enjoyed the journey.
43 years on, what are you looking forward to most about retirement?
I think firstly, I just want to spend the first 5-6 months quality time with my wife and my grandchildren traveling. Mm. I enjoy traveling, so I'll be doing quite a bit of that. And then I'll be looking for an opportunity after March maybe, to maybe put some of my skills back into operation, which will be either as a non-executive in maybe a listed company. I'm in non-profit organizations already. I've got 3 already. Firstly, I'm for the Motus Group that we started the initiative 20 years ago with 1 library in the townships. Today, we've got 83 libraries employing over 100 people, touching the lives of 85,000 children, where we develop the libraries, we stock them with books, we put computers in, and the children would then use the library at our schools. And starting from 1 to 83 or 84 that we've got at the moment, I'll stay on and I'll continue giving the community back. Most of our libraries are around Gauteng, south of Joburg, Sebokeng, Reiger Park, Soweto, El Dorado Park. So we're all over the show. And then obviously we're involved with clinics as well called the Unjani Clinics, whereby we take containers, we refurbish them, and we recruit nurses. And we put these containers in townships where if you get colds and flus and running stomachs, you don't have to rush to the clinic. These nurses are well qualified to give you the medication. They can give you scripts up to Schedule 4. And, you know, that's a great value. And after 5 years, those nurses own those places. So it's theirs. We create entrepreneurs out of nurses. And it's a great achievement. So, and there's one or two others that I'm involved in as well. So giving back to community is quite important for me because, you know, someone gave me something and that's why I am where I am. I'll give back to the community and, I'll still keep in touch with the corporate world. The motor world still excites me, so I'll be putting something back into that community as well. And let's see how it goes. I'm still young and I'm feeling good and I'll add more value.
That's a remarkable story about giving back after you've had the opportunity to have someone pave the way for you. If you're just tuning in, we're in conversation with Osman Arbi. He is the CEO of the Motus Group. We are looking at his career, his life, and we're taking a look at the things he enjoys doing when he's not working. Uncle Osman, you mentioned you enjoy traveling. Your favorite destination?
There's no favorite destination because the world is so big and they're so different. For example, if you go to India, you don't go with the mentality of Europe. You go with a different mentality. Traffic is crazy. Lots of people. Go to Mumbai, there's 25 million people doing the same thing you're doing. Then you go to Europe, which is more relaxing. You go to the Caribbean islands. You go to Alaska. You go to Japan. So they're all, Jimmy, they're all very, very different. And you take one step at a time and you just enjoy the moment and you treasure the moment. So I've got a lot to do in South America that I haven't done. I'll be doing quite a bit of that. I'll be doing the Caribbean islands, more of that. So there's a lot to do. There's a lot to travel. And every travel trip gives me a different opportunity to look at things differently. But the one thing that you may not know, Jimmy, and this comes from a person that was in bed for 6 months in 2018. I had colon cancer. And while they were operating, I got a stroke. And I was not allowed, I couldn't use my right arm, my right leg, and I lost some eyesight. 6 months in bed. A lot of physio, a lot of occupational therapy. And 2019, I came back to run my listed company. And God's been great to me. And my team's been great to me. 6 years later, I am who you're seeing across the mic here, that I've managed to come through. And God's blessed me coming out of that and still running a listed company for 6 years. I can't be more privileged. No prayers are enough that I've done what I needed to do.
That's exceptional. That's absolutely exceptional. Fighting spirit, never giving up and coming back to finish the mission that you had started. Favorite food?
I'm obviously coming from an Indian background. I love my Indian food, but I'm a big into Italian food. Mm-hmm. My pastas and pizzas and things like that. I really love that. And I'm a big seafood person as well. So I love all my king clips and my basses and things like that and soles. The variety I enjoy. Mm. So that's part of my traveling plans, that I can always eat anywhere. I can find food somewhere. And that's what makes it exciting.
Final question. The grandchildren, if you could impart one piece of wisdom to them that they will carry from granddad for the rest of their lives, what would that be?
I did it for my children and I'll do it for my grandchildren as well. It's give them the best education. Coming from an Indian environment, I went to an Indian school, an Indian university. And to me, those are the biggest blinkers that were brought on me. Not by me, but by what happened at that time. So I made sure that my children didn't go to an Indian school. They went to an international school that was publicly recognized, where the cultures were different. There was a mixture of cultures, kids from different backgrounds. So I would make sure that my grandchildren get the same privilege of getting the best education in a culture that's widespread. They learn different cultures. Cultures are not taught in a home. Cultures are learnt in school, in the sporting environment, and you want your children and grandchildren to appreciate the world from a very wide lens so they can appreciate things that, yes, we are privileged, there's people less privileged. There are people that are white, black, or brown. Doesn't mean they superior, inferior, or anything like that. They people just coming from a different background. And
we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much, Uncle Osman, for joining us. Thank you for sharing of your life and your career and your journey. We wish you all of the best in your retirement. That was Osman Arbi, the CEO at Motus, joining us for our Executive Lounge segment. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.